there is, I think, a new resolve to address the North Korea issue.
Analysts discuss options for North Korea following a rocket engine test. It's Tuesday, March 21st. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Hello and welcome. We also invite you to join us on Facebook right now at VOA Asia. Also, Japan sails ahead to the South China Sea. A preview of the Hong Kong election, plus training paramedics in Nepal. We climb to great heights right now on VOA Asia. South Korea says North Korea's latest rocket engine test showed meaningful progress in its missile capability. That's a spokesman for the defense ministry who says the engine is composed of a main engine and four auxiliary engines and appears to be a significant advancement. The North on Sunday announced the ground test for an engine to be used in its space and satellite launching program. The announcement came at the end of a three-nation Asia trip by U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, who met with officials in Japan, South Korea, and China. In South Korea, he warned the North, a military response remains on the table should it threaten South Korean and U.S. forces. Under former President Barack Obama's strategic patience policy, the United States refused to engage with the Kim Jong-un regime until it committed to end its nuclear program, while also responding to provocations with increasing military deterrence, economic sanctions, and diplomatic isolation. Northeast Asia security analyst Daniel Pinkston with Troy University in Seoul says there are basically three options. One, to surrender and appease to North Korea, just give them everything they want. The second option, preventative war and use force to disarm North Korea. And the third option that Pinkston said, which he claims is the best of the three and the default option, deterrence and containment. Tufts University Korea specialist Sung Yun-yi told VOA's Victor Beatty that Tillerson was less strident in his tone about Pyongyang and China than he was when he was in Japan and South Korea.
In Japan, he said, the past 20 years of nuclear diplomacy vis-a-vis North Korea has failed, meaning the U.S. is now poised to try something much more aggressive, something totally different. And then on his stopover in South Korea, Mr. Tillerson said that all options are on the table, including military strike. Now, all options are on the table in principle. But for the U.S. Secretary of State to say so on his visit to South Korea, that is a difference, big difference between saying it and not saying it. So whether there is any substance behind that threat or it's just mere bluster remains to be seen. But the tone was quite serious, that the U.S. is really bent on pressuring North Korea and even going after Chinese banks, entities that may facilitate North Korea's weapons development.
Mr. Xi is supposed to meet next month with President Trump. Will North Korea be the top issue between those or other issues?
It will be among the top, of course, as it always is. But the Chinese position is the same. For the past 30 years, the Chinese have counseled patience, no war, please calm down, dialogue. I think the real change that I detect in Washington, and even just looking at the Secretary of State's visit to East Asia just now over the past few days, is that in the new Trump administration, there is, I think, a new resolve to address the North Korea issue by going after North Korea's illicit activities, blocking, designating North Korean entities that engage in illicit activities like proliferation, money laundering, human rights violations even, and censorship, and also penalizing going after North Korea's Chinese partners. So I think the United States belatedly, after 25 years of procrastination and half measures, feels that that era of baffling, soothing expedience is now over, and in its place we have entered a period of consequences.
Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi on Monday repeated the view that his government is committed to the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula through dialogue. He said any chance for dialogue must be seized as long as there is hope. These are among some of the top Asia stories that are currently trending on VOANews.com. Pakistan reopens Afghan border as a goodwill gesture. A new law may help with forced conversions of Pakistani Hindu girls. $75 million pledged to protect heritage sites in war zones. Nepal to strap some Everest climbers with GPS device. And Pakistan reopening its Afghan border. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and more on Facebook at VOA Asia and also on the VOANews.com website. VOA Asia continues as Japan is building up its influence in the South China Sea, the most widely contested body of water in Asia, to curb Chinese expansion and garner support for its broader military as well as economic interests. The U.S. Naval Institute's news website says in May, Japan will send its Izumo helicopter carrying warship to the South China Sea for 3 months of port visits in Southeast Asia before directing it onward to the Indian Ocean for drills with the United States. Colin Koh, Maritime Security Research Fellow at Nanyang Technological University in Singapore, tells VOA the vessels can be used for a multitude of purposes.
You see this warship more as a multi-purpose platform. It can do humanitarian assistance and disaster relief. It can do anti-submarine warfare. So a few signals that Japan wants to send via this deployment.
China's foreign ministry spokesperson reacted on Thursday to the word about the warship by urging that Tokyo refrain from causing trouble in the region and, quote, respect related countries' efforts to maintain peace and stability. Six other governments call all or part of the South China Sea their own, creating friction since the 1960s. Over the past decade, China has angered the others by using landfill to expand tiny islets and build military installations on some of them to fortify its claim to about 95% of the sea. Analysts say Japan, which does have maritime territorial disputes with Beijing in the East China Sea, will be sending the ship as part of a longer-term effort to vie with China's influence in Southeast Asian coastal states while cooperating with the United States to bolster a broader power base in Asia. Japan's foreign ministry said last year it hoped China would comply with a July 2016 World Arbitration Court ruling against the Chinese claim of about 95% of that sea. The Philippines had filed for the arbitration, but China rejected the ruling, and that might be one reason why Japan is sending its vessels into the area, says Andrew Young, Secretary General with the Chinese Council of Advanced Policy Studies think tank in Taiwan.
Today, it's continuously proactive in terms of providing assistance to the ASEAN countries in terms of conducting judicial patrol in the region and also sending the warships visiting ASEAN countries, very much in line with their emphasis on the rule-based behavior.
The United States says it hopes to stop Chinese island building in the South China Sea and ensure freedom of navigation, an agenda that has angered Beijing but found a match in Tokyo. Koh says Japan also cares about the safety of undersea communications infrastructure and China's compliance with international laws. Japan and China dispute the 8 uninhabited Senkaku Islands in the East China Sea. Analysts say Tokyo's influence in Southeast Asia, along with its close U.S. security relationship, could draw wider sympathy to its Senkaku claim. Tokyo controls the islets, which are 370 kilometers southeast of Okinawa, called Diaoyu in China. It regularly reports spotting Chinese military aircraft flying over nearby waters. Happening now in Asia, Russian and Japanese foreign and defense ministers met in Tokyo, both sides expressing hope that that meeting might help resolve a territorial dispute by focusing on joint development. North Korea terrorism also on the agenda. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're always glad to have you with us on VOA Asia. Thanks for listening. A Beijing-backed panel will gather next Sunday to select the next leader of Hong Kong, a population of 7.3 million people. The vote follows several years of unrest and uncertainty in the former British colony, and although the 1,194 voting members of the election committee will be casting secret ballots. Observers say China has already made clear which of the three candidates it prefers, and it's even issued a veiled warning through pro-Beijing media that the committee should not trigger a constitutional crisis by voting against the choice of the central government. The risk of that happening ought to be small. A little more than a quarter of the body derives from the pro-democracy camp, which has decided to vote as a bloc. The other three-quarters of the committee are controlled by Beijing. The leading candidate is former Chief Secretary Carrie Lam, a career civil servant who stepped down as the city's number two official in order to run, and she's widely believed to be Beijing's preferred candidate. Critics have called her CY 2.0, as she already has negative poll ratings, those below those of the current chief executive, CY Leung, when he assumed office. The second choice is a more laid-back and popular candidate, John Song Chunhua, a former financial secretary who also resigned his cabinet post to be a candidate. He's been nicknamed Pringles for his resemblance to a photo on the chip logo. Ronnie Tong, meanwhile, a former legislator who now heads the Path of Democracy think tank, tells VOA in an online interview that he doubts if any of the leading candidates could be popularly accepted, citing the way that Carrie Lam was being vilified on her Facebook page. He says there's great opposition than when CY Leung was elected. John Song says that he's not getting any support from the pro-government people or Beijing, and if elected, fears that Hong Kong may face a constitutional crisis divided over where, quote, we Hong Kong are going and how one country, two systems should go on. The one country, two systems system is the China-approved constitutional arrangement under which Hong Kong is allowed to be a capitalist system, the common law legal system, and have a high degree of autonomy. The winning candidate in this election must get at least 601 votes. That's more than half of the official size of the 1,200-member election committee. You're listening to VOA Asia.
News happens around the clock, and VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock, on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
This news alert from VOA Asia. Vietnam's prime minister sought support for the nation's stance in the South China Sea when he met South Korea's foreign minister on Monday. Vietnam is the country most openly at odds with China over the waterway since the Philippines pulled back from confrontation under President Rodrigo Duterte. Stay up to date on all the big stories on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. China, the world's third largest bond market, accounting for $9 trillion in debt instruments, has begun the process of opening up to foreign investors. Two major investment banks have announced plans to join the fray, and several others are expectantly watching the unfolding situation. It's not said to be a sudden desire to liberalize, but rather pressure from shrinking foreign capital inflows and expanding outflows that has motivated Beijing's communist leaders into this new and uncertain path. China has suffered some serious loss of capital because of uncontrolled outflows and a recent decline in its foreign direct investments. The country also suffered its first trade deficit in 3 years last month. To help overcome that situation, Beijing recently allowed overseas investors to hedge their currency risks at the local derivative market. This partially opened the doors to foreign players who saw currency risk as a major deterrent in the Chinese bond market. But foreign investors will have to tread carefully because it's not easy to seriously analyze credit risk in China, where the markets are not transparent and there's not much information available about issuers and major buyers of debt instruments, according to Lourdes Casanova, director of Emerging Markets Institute at Cornell University's S.C. Johnson School of Management. Multinational banks based in China and the Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank and the New Development Bank faced some past criticism as they got started. VOA Beijing-based reporter Seibel Gastupa looked into their performance over the past year and spoke with analysts about what changes they face going forward. He shared his findings with VOA Asia's Steve Miller.
They have defied all critics. You know, the critics say that
you have 56 countries and they will fight with each other and nothing will get done. Critics said that China will not go by environmental standards, labor standards. China will do nothing that is logically done by a multilateral institution like World Bank or Asian Development Bank. So AIB would also do the same thing, would not be able to do it because China won't allow it to do it. But all this did not happen. And why it did not happen? It did not happen because the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank simply did not do any vetting of new projects. It only borrowed projects that had been vetted and prepared by the World Bank and Asian Development Bank, and it went on to finance them. Not only that, the new bank actually joined hands with World Bank and ADB to co-finance them. So it did not take much risk. It did not take the burden of due diligence. But in the process, it showed wonderful performance. It lent $1.7 billion in a period of 1 year. It covered 9 different projects in 8 countries.
As the AIIB and these multinational banks that are based out of China have to perform their due diligence for new programs, do they have any concerns now that the United States is really in the first 100 days of the Trump administration?
There are 2 real big concerns. You see, the Fitch Ratings recently came out with a report only last month saying that most of the projects on the One Belt, One Road or Silk Road program are unbankable. They are unreliable. They are politically risky. Now comes the second issue about the Trump administration. If the Trump administration really goes ahead and puts heavy duty on Chinese goods coming to the U.S., if the Trump administration really steps in and cuts down the amount of Chinese investment to the U.S., then there will be a major psychological setback to a lot of these projects, and there will be very few people coming forward to support them.
Saibal Gastuba is in Beijing. Thank you so much for joining me.
Hi, thanks a lot.
Developing at this hour in Asia, U.S. security officers are in Nauru taking biometric data from refugees, some of whom will be given a chance to come to the United States as residents. The United States has agreed to accept about 1,250 refugees from Nauru. VOA Asia keeps you informed all day on Facebook at VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, in a medical emergency, an ambulance with a qualified medical team on board can definitely be a lifesaver. But in Nepal, this service is rare, if not non-existent. So to help provide the best possible medical emergency services, a team of doctors from Stanford University in California just spent 12 weeks training 4 dozen medical technicians in Kathmandu. VOA's Faiza El-Masri has this story as Faith Lapidus narrates.
In Kathmandu, Nepal, with traffic congestion almost around the clock, it takes a long time for an ambulance to get to its destination. And when it finally arrives, it might not provide much help. That's what happened when Subhash Dangal's father passed out and needed to get to the hospital.
Our expectation was they would come with trained personnel, someone who could perform a CPR, but it was not there. So that was... Eventually, when we reached the hospital, it's okay. But, you know, imagine this situation. If somebody really needed the CPR, you know, this kind of service was not there.
In the entire nation of 26 million people, only 3 private hospitals and 1 nonprofit group have ambulances with emergency medical technicians on board.
We have ambulance drivers on some of the ambulances, and certainly it's helpful to have people get to the hospital quickly, but... if there's no difference in the ambulance and a taxi, if the person is not really trained to use equipment to save their life on the way.
So this training program by doctors from Stanford University was set up to help.
So really what we're trying to do is just make positive changes for emergency care in Nepal to make emergency care more accessible to everyone in Nepal.
The training covers providing first aid, treating trauma and heart patients, and even delivering babies.
While training to be EMT, we're learning about life support and to help in life-threatening situations before reaching the hospital, like delivery care, treating trauma victims, dealing with heart attack patients. After reaching hospitals, there's all the equipment and resources, but we have to do whatever is available locally to save patients before reaching hospital.
The goal is to have knowledgeable, well-trained EMTs on ambulances, not just in the capital of Kathmandu, but in the entire country. For writer Faiza El-Masri, I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
Pakistan and India, after a gap of nearly 2 years, have revived talks on a World Bank-mediated treaty that regulates sharing of the Indus River and its tributaries between the nuclear-armed rivals. The two-day meeting of the Water Commission began Monday in Islamabad, and officials said the discussions focused on designs of three controversial hydropower projects India plans to build on the Chenab River. Pakistan believes the planned Pakal-Dul Lower Kalnai and Miar power generation facilities violate a 1960 water treaty that could disrupt water flow into Pakistan. 80% of Pakistan's agricultural land is irrigated. This irrigation depends on rivers flowing into the country from India. One of the stories we'll continue to follow for you at voanews.com and on our Facebook page at VOA Asia. You've been listening to VOA Asia. Be sure to also check out our program as a podcast. It's at voanews.com. You can download the program anytime that you like. Our thanks to engineer Daryl Smith, our director Tracy Carter, managing editor Diane Gao, and our wonderful VOA Asia team. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We hope you have a super day. Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
It's been 3 years since Russia seized and occupied Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula. Russia then staged an illegitimate referendum in which residents of Crimea were compelled to vote while heavily armed foreign forces occupied their land, noted acting State Department spokesperson Mark Toner in a recent press statement. The United States, he said, does not recognize Russia's so-called referendum of March 16, 2014, nor its attempted annexation of Crimea and continued violation of international law. We once again reaffirm our commitment to Ukraine's sovereignty and territorial integrity. Since the occupation of Crimea 3 years ago, Russian authorities have moved systematically to suppress dissent in the peninsula. Human rights monitors have documented enforced disappearances, extrajudicial killings, torture, and punitive psychiatric hospitalizations, said Mr. Toner. Crimean Tatars, ethnic Ukrainians, pro-Ukrainian activists, and independent journalists have been subjected to politically motivated prosecution and ongoing repression. Mr. Toner noted that Russian occupation authorities have silenced and forced the closure of non-governmental organizations and independent media. International observers have been denied access to the peninsula. In addition, the State Department's most recent reports on the state of human rights, as well as on the condition of religious freedom in Crimea, point out that Russian installed authorities have taken few steps to investigate or prosecute officials or individuals who have committed human rights abuses, created an atmosphere of impunity and lawlessness, and that religious congregations not explicitly loyal to Russia are subject to harassment and intimidation. The United States calls on Russia to cease its attempts to suppress freedom of expression, peaceful assembly, association, and religion, said acting State Department spokesperson Toner. Crimea is a part of Ukraine. The United States again condemns the Russian occupation of Crimea and calls for its immediate end. Our Crimea-related sanctions will remain in place, he added, until Russia returns control of the peninsula to Ukraine.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.